Father, we thank you for your word, which shines as our light in this dark world. Amen. And leads us to your kingdom. We thank you for the way in which you have had your hand over it through the ages, and we thank you for its present to us today. We thank you for it in Jesus' name. Well, Wednesday night I was watching the Christmas tree be lit on television in the Wednesday night at the Rockefeller Center. And then Thursday night I was watching the PBS episode about the migration of the monarch butterflies. And it's one of nature's miracles that these butterflies make it for 2,000 miles and down all the way down to Mexico, and then they head back the next year and they hang on those trees. That's one of God's miracles. And so one of the miracles we're going to study tonight is God's Word. And how did this miracle come to us? I want to start with three general principles. And the first general principle is the Bible is the oldest living literature of the Western world. See, I don't know about the Eastern world. The Chinese bronzes are in Taipei, and they're back to 2000 BC, and I don't know how much living literature they have. But the Bible has always, since Moses wrote the Pentateuch, it has always been here and always been in action. And so in some periods of time, during the apostasy under the kings, for example, in the Old Testament, the Bible, its light was dim, but it came back up. It's always been, from the time Moses wrote the Pentateuch down till today, it has been a living book. The next competitor for that is Homer, whose works were written in the 8th century B.C. So you're jumping from the 15th century B.C. to the 8th century B.C. for a book that has lived to the present. Now, there is older literature. The Assyrians and the Egyptians, their writing goes back to about 3,000 B.C. approximately, plus or minus a couple centuries. But it died out. Those are dead languages. And so, it's like the child's joke about Latin. Latin is a language dead. First it killed the Romans, and now it's killing me. So, the Bible is the oldest living piece of literature in the Western world. That, in and of itself, says something about its inspiration. How did that happen? Is that just an accident? No, it's because of God's provision. Second point, the Bible is the best documented piece of literature of the Western world. Now, to give you an example, we have, until 1947, copies of the Bible, the Old Testament I'm speaking of now, that went back to about 850 A.D. Got to get my B.C. and D straightened out here. And then, in that period, that brought to the work of the Masoretes. You may have heard of the Masoretes. They were very careful scribes. They were copying the copies of the Scriptures, and they produced their final results or works from 850 to about 1000 A.D. And we have several major collections there. And then in 1947, the discoveries, the Dead Sea Scrolls, which took our knowledge of the Old Testament back 1,000 years. The Dead Sea Scrolls date to the 2nd century B.C., the 1st century B.C., and the 1st century A.D., until the Romans conquered Qumran in 73 A.D. So that's point number two. Point number three is there is no such thing as a perfect translation. Anytime you go from one language, it doesn't matter whether it's secular or sacred or whatever it is, anytime you go from one language to another language, you lose something. And let me illustrate. Here is the Hebrew Bible. It happens to be the 7th edition of the Kittle Bible, which was published in 1951. Kittle was no longer alive. He died in 1929. But his work was carried on by Paul Kalle and Otto Eisfeld. And this edition was published in 1951. But if you put the English Old Testament on top of this, it is a third longer. In other words, to translate this compact language into English, you have to use a third more words, which shows you already you have problems when you make translations. Hebrew is a very compact language, and I've given you the Shea Standard Version for a little phrase in Daniel 9:25. After it says that Jesus will be cut off, the Messiah will be cut off, it says, four Hebrew letters. Ein lo. Ein is the negative of the verb to be. Lo is the preposition plus the pronominal suffix. The negative of the verb to be. There shall not be. How many words is that? There shall not be. Four words it takes to translate two letters. And then lo, l, a preposition. And the o at the end is a pronominal suffix. To or for him. So you have four letters in two words in Hebrew, and you have six English words to translate it. And the translators still don't know what it means. I think it means, no one shall be for him. That is to say, at the time he was cut off, not during his whole ministry, but at the time he was cut off, no one would be for him. And that's exactly the picture of the gospel when Jesus hung on the cross. Everybody, even his disciples, we thought this would be he who would deliver Israel. They didn't get it. They didn't know it. Now, let's talk a little bit about modern books. And I brought some. There are lots and lots of books about the history of the English Bible. And here's the first one, which I used as a class book in 1951 at La Sierra College. And I thought the course on ancient manuscripts of the Bible was boring, and I thought this was a terribly hard book to read, and I still think it's a terribly hard book to read. Now, the next three books are not my books, but my father-in-law's books. I gave them to him as gifts, and so they're all inscribed. And this one is God's Word into English by Dewey Beagle. Dewey Beagle used to teach at the Wesley Seminary downtown, right next to American University. And you might be mildly amused at the little footnote that I wrote to my father-in-law when I gave him the book. Peter Van Debelen, who shared my office, found this at a used bookstore sale for 75 cents. Quite a coup. I saw Dewey Beagle at the New Orleans meetings at the Society of Biblical Journey. He said it was out of print, but was going to be reprinted by a new press in Ann Arbor. Happy birthday, see you again. And so here's another one. So Many Versions by Sakai Kubo and Walter Specht. These are both Seventh-day Adventists who spent 40 years teaching. I should, in passing, mention my poor history in Greek. I took Greek, is it still coming through? Help. I guess I've got it. I took Greek at La Sierra College. First semester, I got an A. Second semester, I got a B. Third semester, I got a C. Fourth semester, I got a C minus. Narrowly escaped a D. And my teacher at that time was Walter Specht. So this book of theirs covers the modern versions of the Bible since 1901. And it was so popular, they reprinted it in 1983. And this is really an excellent book. It's a dictionary of modern translations. Everyone, it tells you who wrote it. A little bit biography about him, good things about it, bad things about it, text that it uses, and then that's kind of a summary. So this is like a dictionary of modern translation. And then another one published the same year, From Ancient Tablets to Modern Translations by David Ewart. I had never read this book before, so I browsed through about four chapters of it this week, and I was amazed to see how good this book is. His English flows. And you'd think he was writing the King James Version. And he tells humorous stories about the translators. For example, we'll get into something called the lectionaries, which were versions of the Bible made for reading in churches. And the monks of the Middle Ages who wrote these had to stand up at the desk all day. And so they would put in the margins of their lectionaries, one will say, "It's so cold in here, my hands are frozen." Or one of them will say, "I've been standing up so long, my back hurts." You know, they have all these personal reminiscences of their experience. So these are just a sample. This only takes us to 1983, and my father-in-law died in the late 1980s, so it ended there, and when he passed away, these books reverted back to me. You might be interested to know, my wife looked it up on the website today, this book, So Many Versions, do you know how much this costs at Amazon.com? One penny plus the shipping. One penny plus the shipping. That's what she said, that it came off the web. So I would highly recommend it. So if you really want to get into the study, start with this book and then go to this book. That's the order of procedure. Now, about the Hebrew Bible. The Masoretes worked from the 6th century A.D. to the 9th century A.D. There are 7 rules of translation are given in the Talmud, and some of them are very strange. Some of them are in order to keep the transmission quite accurate. And their work culminated in the products of that school that came out about 900 A.D. Now, there was one family, the Ben Asher family. Moses Ben Asher was the father. Aaron Ben Asher was the son. The father produced the final translation of the Torah. It's now in London, about 850 A.D. I'm always getting in trouble with it. So you'll know I'm talking about A.D. here. The son completed the prophets. Now, in Hebrew, the prophets are not what we call the prophets, the major prophets and the minor prophets. The prophets, the former prophets, are from Joshua to 2 Kings. That's the former prophets. And the latter prophets are, you know, from Isaiah to including the book of the 12. So the son, Aaron ben Asher, produced that edition 895 A.D. So their complete Bible was completed 895 A.D. That book was found in Cairo. The second edition is known as the Leningrad Codex. And that was produced in the year 1008. You see, some of these scribes put the date on their manuscripts. And the third edition is the Aleppo Codex, found in a synagogue in Syria, and that dates to 930 A.D. And so these are the 3 major families. There was another family, the Ben Naphtali text, that was a rival for the Ben Asher text. We don't know much about Ben Naphtali, whether that was a man's name or it was just a pseudonym, because Naphtali was a tribe in Israel. And so these 2 editions, the Ben Asher text and the Ben Naphtali text, there's 895 differences between the two. Now, when I say differences, these differences are minimal. These are matters of punctuation. They're matters of vocalization. You see, one of the jobs of the Masoretes was to put those vowel points in. You see, when you look at the Dead Sea Scrolls, there's no vowels. There are vowel letters occasionally, letters. The aleph was sometimes used for A, the vav or W was sometimes used for O or U, and the yod was sometimes used for I or E. But that was only occasional. That was not on regular basis. And so you have to vocalize these words, and that's what the Masoretes set about doing. And so there were, you know, there's different ways to vocalize these words, and with that you get the difference between a noun and a participle, or a noun and an infinitive, or a participle and an infinitive, or what have you. And, of course, there has been made a catalog of scribal errors. And the easiest place to see the scribal errors is not in these versions of the Hebrew Bible, but in the Dead Sea Scrolls. They would do a line, and they would write the letters underneath the line, and they would make their corrections. You can see the corrections in the Dead Sea Scrolls. And here brings up the difference between you have scribes and you have scribes. There are scribes and then there are scribes. And a classic case of this is the Great Isaiah Scroll. The Great Isaiah Scroll is 22 feet long. It has the whole book of Isaiah on it. And they had it on display, unrolled around, in the book of the scroll in next to the Hebrew, the Israel Museum in Jerusalem. And unfortunately, this scribe was a fast and rather inaccurate copyist. And so he made a lot of mistakes and had to make a lot of corrections. Now, there is another copy of the book of Isaiah that about 2/3 of it has been preserved. And this was a very cautious, careful scribe. And so we have the paradox that the short Isaiah scroll was done by a very careful scribe, and the long scroll was done by a very sloppy scribe. So this sloppy scribe had to make a lot of mistakes, a lot of corrections, and the scribe of the short scroll just had to make a few. So that's the difference in scribes. And, you know, there's a whole catalog of mistakes that scribes can make. They can make mistakes of eyes. You can double a word. You can read one word for another. Or you can skip over a piece of line. You might have the same word on 2 lines and your eye can skip. So these have all been categorized and these mistakes all occur. And let me give you one example for hearing. You see, sometimes they copied from visually from a scroll, and sometimes they had a lector in front who read the scroll and they copied. And if I say ecumen and I say ecumen, can you get the difference? You think a scribe would have got the difference? It's the difference between a short O and a long O. And the difference between a short O and a long O makes a difference in how you translate that word. So these are common scribal errors that occur. So the aim of the Masoretes was to correct all of this and keep it all together and to make the best scroll that they could. And then comes the discovery of the Dead Sea Scrolls, which we could talk about for an hour, but I'll just give you a brief synopsis. They were discovered in 1947 while the war was going on, the War of Independence for Israel. And this was a little boy who was herding his goats down near Jericho, just north of Jericho. And he's called Mohammed the Wolf, and he came from the Tamira Bedouin tribe. And he was trying to get his goats down off a hillside, and he was pelting them with stones. And he heard a clink when that stone hit a piece of pottery. So he climbed up, and he found there was a cave. And in the cave were all these tall jars, because the scrolls were wide, and they had kind of funny-shaped lids. Some had fallen over and broken, and the rodents of the desert got to chewing them. And so the cave four, there were 12 caves that they hid scrolls in. As the Romans were approaching, 73 A.D. to destroy Qumran, Jerusalem was destroyed in 70, Qumran was destroyed in 73, and they hid these in 12 caves along the edge of the top of the mountain. And cave four, which had perhaps the originally largest number of scrolls, with the rodents of the desert doing their work on them, they came to about 10,000 pieces, fragments, 10,000. And so when they took them all to Jerusalem and put them under glass, they said, this is the world's largest jigsaw puzzle. And one of my teachers was on that committee, Frank Cross, and they had an international committee. And that committee worked very slowly, unfortunately. And so much supposed scandal has been made out of this. I don't think it's a scandal. My interpretation is, if you work with scholars, what you find out is when they publish something, they want to publish it perfect so nobody will criticize what they have done. And so if you're going to do that, you take 25 years to publish this scroll. But there's one fellow, James Sanders by name, who was given the Psalm scroll. There's 41 Psalms out of 150, 41 survived. And he published that in 1952. He was given it to work on about 1949 or 50, and he published it in 52. And I heard him lecture on it. I drove down to the USC campus in Los Angeles to listen to him. That was about 1955. And so he did an exemplary job of getting that Psalm scroll out. Now, I might mention a little bit about the Dead Sea Scrolls in modern discussions. I used to be a member of the Graysonville Church, and we had a fellow there who loved the King James Bible, and he had good reason for doing so. He was a carpenter. He was illiterate. He couldn't read or write. I guess he could write numbers to make bills for his carpentry work, but that's been about it. And his wife taught him to read using the King James Bible. And so, of course, he loved the King James Bible. But, you know, that didn't bother him in the least. He was a dear, sweet man, and I loved him like a brother. And I went to his funeral just a year or two ago. And when he would get up and teach in Sabbath school, you know, he would hammer away at the King James Version, the King James. So one day, just to see what his reaction was, I took the Dead Sea Scroll for the book of Isaiah. And I said, would you like to see what Jesus read in the synagogue at Nazareth? And so I flipped it open to Isaiah, what we call Isaiah 61. I said, this is what he would have read. He didn't want to hear it at all. Don't confuse me. Don't confuse me with the facts. So I didn't make much progress with him. But he continued on his way until his dying day as far as his marriage to the King James Version. So the Dead Sea Scrolls have taken us back to the 2nd century B.C. the second to the first century B.C. I have an article here that was written by my colleague at Andrus, Gerhard Hausel, New Light on the Book of Daniel from the Dead Sea Scrolls. You see, the Book of Daniel doesn't, in the Hebrew Bible, it does not occur with the prophets. It occurs at the end of the book, in the writings. You know, Esther, Job, Ecclesiastes, you know, the wisdom books. And then the later Ezra, Nehemiah, and Chronicles, that's the Hebrew Bible. And so some people have said, therefore, Daniel was not considered to be a prophet. And then they went, took that one step further and said Daniel really didn't originally belong to the canon, because in their minds it was only written 165 B.C. That's the literary critical preterist viewpoint, not our viewpoint, which believes it's a genuine work of the 6th century B.C. So what does the fragments of Daniel say about that? Very interesting. You can study the handwriting of the scribes at Qumran, and you can see which belong to different manuscripts. There are eight manuscripts of Daniel at Qumran. Eight. Of course, most of these are just fragments, but they're in different hands. And you can date these fragments by what's called paleography, the shape of the writing. The writing changes. With our King James Bible, originally, you know, the S and the S's look alike, you know, big, tall. One of those Daniel fragments dates to 125 B.C. If the scholarly theory is correct, that's within 40 years of when the book of Daniel was written. But all of these eight fragments of these eight manuscripts show you this was a canonical book. Some come from, how could you have a non-canonical book that would produce eight copies just like this? One to 125 B.C., one to the Herodian hand, 60 B.C. down to 1, and one to the late Herodian hand, 1 to 60. So we have fragments from all of these periods. So that's in light. Now, I said that there's no such thing as a perfect translation. And if you don't have a perfect translation, you're probably bound to get mistakes. And you get spelling mistakes, and you get slips of the scribe's eye, and so on and so forth. But I want to show you what I would call either textual mistakes or historical mistakes. And I just happened to bring with me a book I got when I was at La Sierra College. This is the 1901 version of the Bible. And we'll mention that a little bit because it's a spin-off. It's the American Standard Version, which was a spin-off of the English Revised Version of 1881. And there's a long story about this, the transmission. But I'm going to look at just two texts in 2 Kings. And one is in 2 Kings 23. 2 Kings 23. And let's see, we have to go to chapter 23. And here we have an interesting verse. Let's see, about verse 29. It's about the death of Josiah. Now, in his days, verse 29, in his days, Pharaoh Necho, king of Egypt, went up against the king of Assyria to the river Euphrates, and King Josiah went out against him, and Pharaoh slew him at Megiddo when he had seen him. And then it tells about them taking the body up to Jerusalem and so forth. So you might not recall it, but the hardest thing to translate, one of the hardest things to translate, is prepositions. Because you see, it says, Pharaoh Necho went al, the king of Assyria. Now that preposition can be translated on, upon, over, unto, against. And so you have to pick which treatment of this preposition is correct. Every Bible which was translated before 1956 was wrong. Every Bible. All of them. Now, we have here the Bibles from 1901 to 1985. Anything before 1956 is wrong. They're all wrong because they all took the prepositional meaning of against. In 1956, John J. Wiseman published the Chronicles of the Chaldean Kings, cuneiform tablets from the British Museum. And those cuneiform tablets point out that Pharaoh Necho went up to the king of Assyria, who was in Carchemish, because he wanted to help him fight against the king of Babylon. King of Babylon was trying to push across the Euphrates River, Remember, Nineveh had been destroyed in 612. And so this is what's called the rump kingdom of Assyria. One king and a few hundred soldiers survived. And Pharaoh Necho goes up there, not to fight against him, but to prop him up and protect him against the king of Babylon. So that any translation, and they all have it, that says against is wrong. Because he went unto the king of Assyria to help him fight. They're paired. Now, the next one is, that's an interesting illustration how archaeology helps us to understand the text of the Bible. Now, the next one, I should have kept my place here, is in the next chapter, 2 Kings 24 and verse 8. It talks about the age of, I'll just tell you about it, it talks about the age of Jehoiakim, who's the next of the last king of Judah. And here, in 2 Kings 24, verse 8, it says that he was 18 years when he came. And if you go to 2 Chronicles 39, it said he was 8 years when he came. Well, which is it? Was he 8 or was he 18? And here it helps if you understand how Hebrew numerals were written. They didn't put a 1 or a 2 or a 3 Arabic numerals. They spelled out the words. And so the age of 18 is Shemonah v'Asher. Shemonah, 8. Asher, 10. So it's 8 plus 10. And now you can easily see how this happened. Because the interesting thing, and the reason why I point this out, is we are between inspired manuscripts. You see, the Book of Kings was written about 600 B.C. and the Book of Chronicles was written about 400 B.C., the end of the Old Testament. So they're about 2 centuries apart. And the fellow who is probably Ezra, who is recording the 2 Chronicles 36, has a defective scroll in an inspired scroll. You see, what undoubtedly happened is the author of Kings, whoever he was, wrote Shemonah Asher. And somehow or another, maybe through a fingerprint smudge, you can see the oil on these scrolls as they roll back and forth, or maybe just from the rubbing of the pages. The number 10 was rubbed out, or at least was rubbed so badly he couldn't read it. And so the author of Kings, with his manuscript, only sees 8 there, because the 10 has dropped out of the text just through the process of time. So here's 3 mistakes in the Bible. And here's the age of Jehoiakim, and the translation of the preposition. As I mentioned, translating prepositions is very hard, very difficult sometimes, because you have a semantic range of prepositions. All right, let's go to the New Testament. And the New Testament, we have the sources. And the sources, we start with the papyri, and then we go to the uncials. And this means capitals, because they wrote with caps in these manuscripts. And then you have the minuscules, which is a cursive. And then you go to the lectionaries. The lectionaries were texts of the Bible that were written in paragraphs for reading in the churches. And the Hebrews have the same thing, the Jews today. You go to the synagogue, they have a reading from the Torah, and they have a reading from the prophets. And so the lectionaries, reading books, and this is what I was telling you about these interesting remarks in the margins about how they were suffering when they were doing their copying. And then you come to the printed text, the printed New Testament. Now, in addition, you have all the versions, other languages into which these were translated. And you have Latin, and you have Coptic, and you have Ethiopic, and you have Armenian, and you have Aramaic, and you have Syriac, and you have Gothic in Gaul, and so on and so forth. And then you have quotations in the Church Fathers. And the estimate is there's 1 million of these. You know, we have the Ante-Nicene Fathers, who wrote before 325 A.D., and we have the Post-Nicene Fathers, who wrote after 325 A.D., and that brings us to a whole shelf of volumes, which they have on the shelf at Andrews University that I would use occasionally, but not very often. And so we don't have the time to discuss these or these, but we're just going to stick with these. Now, the ones I like, or the ones that I think are really interesting, are these, because these are the earliest form of the Bible that we have. is in existence today. And basically, they've been sold by antiquities dealers in the Middle East, in Egypt, and they have been distributed in various places. And so one is a collection in England, known as the Chester Beatty papyri, and one in Switzerland is the Bodmer papyri, and one fragment is in the John Rowland's library. And here you have, they go with the designation 45 as the Gospels and Acts, 200 A.D., 46 is the letters of Paul, and that's 247 is the book of Revelation, and that's from 200. And then over here we have 66 is the Gospel of John, and then P75 is John plus Luke, oldest copy of Luke. And that's 175 A.D. And then there's P72, the Epistles of Peter. And then when you come to John Rylands, it's P52. I can always remember this because in War II we had the pursuit of a fighter plane, the P52. And this is a copy of John, just a fragment, 125 A.D. Now, if the Gospel of John was written about 90, and the fragment dates to 125, you're within about 30 years of what's called the author's orthograph, the copy that the author himself wrote. You're within 30 years of it right here. Unfortunately, it's a small fragment, but you can see most of these are 200 A.D. or less. So these are the earliest copies of the Bible. Basically, the reason they were written on or survived is because of the climate of Egypt is favorable for preservation. Now, here's an article that just came in the mail yesterday, Ministry Magazine, hot off the presses. The Reliability of New Testament Scriptures, Early Christians and the Codex. Very interesting article. See, this is the form of a codex. It's a book. It has leaves and it has a binding. And so this is a codex. Of the 134 biblical papyri from Egypt, 134 total, 130 were written as codices. Four were written as scrolls. Now, what is the significance of that? The codex did not come into general use in the Roman world until the 5th century A.D. 5th century A.D., the codex becomes general usage. Now, the gist of the article is why. You see, he starts the article with all the modern technology. And he says, ancient Christians were into technology because they were ahead of the general world in the use of the codex. Why? And, of course, scholars have noticed this factor. And they have studied it and thought about it and written about it. And he discusses about five different theories, and he dismisses all of those theories. And then he gives his theory, which I think is correct. These were written in small pages, and they were easy for transport. So they're for itinerant, traveling missionaries. So the use of the codex in the papyri was because of traveling itinerant preachers, like Paul. Paul's all over the Roman world, three major trips, and then finally on over to Rome and so forth. And he has to take the Bible with him. And then he writes and says, please bring the books and the parchments. The earliest reference to a codex outside of the Bible is a Latin writer in 81 A.D., Martial, Martial or something like that. And so Paul seems to be referring to the same type of feature about the same time or just before. Now, I would add one more thing to what his conclusion, that these are for missionary use, for easy travel. How would you like to carry a 22-foot scroll of Isaiah under your arm? Not so much fun. Number one, it's ease of travel. But number two, can you imagine standing before an audience and preaching with a scroll? With a scroll, you have to use both hands because you have to keep turning the scroll. And so you're standing there, both hands occupied, and you're stuck holding the scroll, opening, closing, running it. But if you have a codex like this in Egypt, you can preach with one hand. And you can say, now, brothers and sisters, listen to this. So that's my supplement to the use of the codex. All right, let's go to the uncials. And I'm going to discuss one that isn't discussed too often because it's very interesting in terms of textual criticism of the English Bible, and that's Codex Alexandrinus. You see, the Codex Sinaiticus and the Codex Vaticanus didn't show up until the 19th century A.D., too late for what we're concerned about. But the Codex Alexandrinus was brought by an Archbishop Volcar, who was the Archbishop of Cairo, and he came to be Archbishop of Constantinople, and he brought this with him. And when Thomas Rowe, the ambassador from England, arrived there in 1267, 1620, that's a metathesis, where the scribe gets it backwards, you know? Metathesis. 1627, Thomas Rowe goes as ambassador to Constantinople, the court of the Ottomans. And he, when he arrives there, this Volcar gives him the scroll, the Codex of the Alexandrinus. He gives it to him. And so 1627, the Alexandrinus migrates from Constantinople back to England. It arrives in England 2 centuries before the other two major codices do. The reason that's important is there was a revision of the King James in 1629. And somebody could do a little historical research and see if any of this in the Alexandrinus affected the revision of the King James Bible at that time. Now, the other two were products of the 19th century, but they really weren't. The Vatican Library records the presence of the Vaticanus in their library in 1475. I have a theory as to how it got there. Still hear this?
Can you still hear this?
In 1453, the city of Constantinople fell to the Turks. And what happened was, the scholars and their manuscripts migrated to Western Europe out of that Holocaust. And so, if you look at the date, 1453, and it shows up in Rome in 1475, I think it was in the library of Constantinople. The scholars who brought all of their manuscripts west brought this west with them. And it shows up in Rome in 1475. But it wasn't translated till the 19th century. The Roman Catholics were not very anxious to displace the Vulgate, the Latin version of the Bible. In fact, even when Erasmus was working on the Greek New Testament, they were asking him, "What are you doing this for? We have the Latin Bible." So it was not translated in the 19th century, but Napoleon took it back as a prize of war. Took it to Paris for a while, and then in 1815 it was returned to Rome. And it stayed there until 1862. One of the heroes of the English Bible is William Tyndale. We'll talk a little bit about it. And the other hero is Tischendorf. And Tischendorf was given the privilege of copying the Vaticanus in 1862. The Catholics themselves did not copy it until about 1900. Tischendorf set out as his goal in life to retrieve as many manuscripts of the New Testament as he could, because higher criticism, born in Germany in the 1790s, was attacking the Bible in every way, shape, and form possible. And Tischendorf says, the way I'm going to disprove this is show how authentic, antique, and original the Bible is. And the first one he worked on is one of the great codices. It's called the Codex Ephraemi. It's in Paris. And this is a very unusual manuscript because it's what's known as a palimpsest. A palimpsest is something that has writing underneath and writing on top. And the writing on top is the sermon of one of the church fathers. And so the joke among translators is, this isn't the first time that a sermon of a pastor has covered up the text of the Bible. So Tischendorf, his eyesight must have gone bad from this work, ferreted out the text of the Codex Ephraemi underneath the sermon of this church pastor, and he published it in 1845. He was working on it from 1841 to 1843 and published it in 1845. In the meantime, in 1844, he went to the monastery in Sinai, St. Catherine's, and he got some sheaves of a Bible that he rescued from the fire. And he knew they were valuable, and he told the monks to anything like this saved. He went back in 1852, didn't get a thing. Went back in 1859, And one monk says, oh, I have a book like that in my library. And he showed him the Codex Sinaiticus. And so, trying to act as calm as he could, he was given permission to look at it in his room. And so he studied it and, was drooling at the mouth by the time he got through. This is a tremendous discovery. It's from the 4th century A.D. And the Alexandrinus is from the 5th century A.D. And the Vaticanus is from the 4th century A.D. I'll tell you why I think those Bibles cropped up. Those big capitals, all of these are written in capitals. The papyri and the uncials, the great uncials. These great big Bibles. What happened in the early 4th century? The persecution of the Christian church stopped. Constantine recognized Christianity as an official religion, and they were permitted to build churches. And if you build a church, you have to have a big Bible to read from the pulpit. And so here these big Bibles were produced to read from the pulpit. Now, that's my theory. So I would date both of these not too long after 325 A.D., when many of these churches started to be constructed. So, Tischendorf published the Codex Ephraemi, 5th century A.D., in 1845. He published the Sinaiticus in 1862, and he published the Vaticanus in 1867. And he's the man of the major codices. Now, there are late codices, and what happened is, I never studied these capitals in Greek. I never learned them. Because everything you study in this Greek New Testament, this is the third edition of the United Bible Society Greek New Testament. And it's all written in cursive. Because cursive, the scribes could write the cursive a lot faster than they could write these uncials or capitals. And so there was a changeover about the 9th or 10th century that you go from these uncials to these minuscules. So we come now to the story of Erasmus, the father of the Greek New Testament. And it's an interesting story. He started out going into the monastery as a monk. He was a Roman Catholic all of his life. He didn't suit the monastery, or the monastery didn't suit him, so he left the monastery. He went to England to study Greek with John Colet and Sir Thomas More. But he developed the idea of creating a Greek New Testament, and he was in a race because he heard that Cardinal Ximenes of Spain was trying to publish the first Greek New Testament in printing, of course, Gutenberg of the previous century. And so he went to Basel, and in Basel he found five manuscripts. They were all from the 12th century A.D. They're all minuscules, and he just numbered them 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And there's an interesting story here because he used papyrus number 2 for his major evidence, and he used 3, 4, and 5 to support it. But he didn't take one into account. He said it has too many eccentric readings, and he left it aside. Now, what we found later is papyrus 1 fits better with these great uncials than it does with the minuscules later. So Erasmus published 5 editions of his New Testament. The first two, there's a very famous story about the Trinitarian statement in 1 John 5:7, about there are 3 in heaven, the Father, the Word, and the Spirit, and these 3 are one. And Erasmus did not find this in any of his Greek manuscripts. He said it doesn't belong there. It's been inserted. And Cardinal Ximenes didn't like that, because he said, anybody who finds a manuscript that has it in, I'll put it in. And so Cardinal Ximenes found one in Ireland, in a remote monastery in Ireland from the 15th or 16th century, a very suspicious circumstance. And so he said, okay, you found it, I'll put it in. So he put it in. So his 3rd, 4th, and 5th editions have it in there. But since that time, only 3 manuscripts, and actually now it's up to 5, have that statement. Of the 5,700 manuscripts of the New Testament that we have. So he was probably right in the first place. It was an insertion. Now, of these 5,700 manuscripts, only 60 are complete manuscripts. Only 60. So that means the other 5,000 and
610 are fragmentary. Some of them very large fragments, some of them very small fragments, but they're fragmentary. Only 60 complete Greek New Testaments from antiquity. So there were five English Bibles. Remember, the great hero of the English Bible is Tyndale. And Tyndale went back to the Greek and Hebrew. He actually used the Complutensian Polyglot from Cardinal Ximenes more than he used Erasmus' Greek New Testament. And from him, there's the Matthew Bible, the Geneva Bible, the Bishop's Bible. Strange things happen. King Henry VIII, when the Great Bible was produced, and it's called the Great Bible because of the size of the pages, 16 by 11 pages, he said all the previous Bibles should be burned, which is just what the Catholics were doing. pretty curious or unintelligent approach. But with the approach of King Edward VI to the throne, unfortunately it lasted a short time, the Protestant Bible makers were given free rein to produce Bibles freely. And so then we have the Geneva Bible, which didn't go over too well in England because it had Calvinistic footnotes. And so finally the Bishop's Bible was the last one. And then we had three editions of the Greek New Testament. Those are English Bibles. Tyndale had to leave England in order to produce his Bibles. He had to leave Cologne when he only had the Book of Matthew done. Had to go to Worms, Germany for a while. Then he came back to Antwerp, because Antwerp was a free city where he could not be touched by the Catholic authorities. And a spy turned him over and took him to Brussels, which is a Catholic city, and he was imprisoned and eventually taken to the north coast of France, where he was strangled and then burned at the stake. So his work on the New Testament, he published in 1526. He published his New Testament, and his Old Testament followed shortly, I think by 1535. So we have the English Bibles between Tyndale and 1611, and we have the Greek New Testaments. All right, Erasmus produced five editions. You know, he keeps adding as he gets more manuscripts. And then after he died in 1536, a guy named Stephanus did another edition in 1551. He's the one who put verses in the Bible. Chapters were put in the Bible back in the 12th century AD. And the same joke is told about both of these guys. The story about the Englishman who put the chapters in the Latin Bible is he was an itinerant preacher and priest, and so every time the horse bucked, he got the chapter division in the wrong place. And so the same story is told about Stephanus. He was riding his horse from Paris to Lyon, and every time the horse bucked, he got the verse division in the wrong place. So the same joke, undoubtedly apocryphal for in both cases, but makes a good story, and is told about both of these people. And after him came Theodore Bizet, who was a disciple of John Calvin. And his edition was produced in 1604, so it was available to be used by the translators of the King James Bible. There was a large committee set up, and of course, different portions of the Bible were partioned out, and there was a review committee and a review committee, and then the final publication in 1611. And I thought I might look at the King James Bible. First of all, it's a revision. It's not a unique, original translation. It's a revision of Tyndale's Bible. And anybody who reads these manuscripts says 90% of the King James Bible is the Tyndale Bible. 10% is new work of the committee. And King James Bible underwent revisions, and so this book by Kubo and Specht covers all of the versions from 1901 till they wrote their book in 1883. I know of two Bibles. There's undoubtedly more. I just haven't followed it very much that had been published since. One is the ESV, and English Standard Version, and it's a fresh new translation from the Greek and Hebrew. And Bible teachers in Adventist colleges really like this translation. The other one just came out this year. It's the Revised NIV. And the Revised NIV has done something which I think is a mistake. You see, there's the old RSV. And I used to check the old RSV against the Hebrew, the Old Testament, of course, against the Hebrew, hundreds and hundreds of places. And it is an excellent, excellent translation of the Hebrew. The NRSV decided that they would delete gender from their translation. So where it says the sons of so-and-so would do thus and so, they would say the ones who. See, that's gender all-inclusive, so you women are included. So if you like that better, you can read the NRSV instead of the old RSV. I like to translate what the text says. That's my philosophy. You can say this is meaning inclusivity, sons and daughters. One of these revisions of the King James is of particular interest to me, and I'll read you just a paragraph here about these revisions. There was one revision within 2 years. Let's see here. Here it is. A revision containing more than 300 differences from the 1611 edition was published in 1613. Sharp criticism of the version by such men as Hugh Broughton forced the Cambridge University Press to publish a further revision in 1629. That, I think, is an interesting date, because two things happened just before then. Number one, there was a new Greek Old Testament published in Holland by the Elsevier brothers, and it was 1624, so it was there to impact this 1629 edition. And the second thing is, the Codex Alexandrinus came from Constantinople in 1627, and here's the revision in 1629. So it would be an interesting doctoral thesis to explore, to see how much the Alexandrinus Codex Uncial affected the 1629 revision. But we're not done yet. In 1638, an attempt was made to produce an authentic corrected Bible by a small committee that included two of the original translators. 15 years later, 1653, the Long Parliament called for another revision because of the errors in printing, translation, and language. But when Cromwell, the Lord Protector, dissolved Parliament and took over the government, nothing took place. Nothing came of the proposal. A revision in the spelling was made in 1675 by John Fell, Dean of Christ Church, Oxford. More extensive revisions were made in the 18th century. In 1762, Dr. Thomas Paris of Trinity College, Cambridge, published his newly corrected edition. This was followed by the work of Dr. Benjamin Blaney of Oxford in 1769. And that, as it says here, this edition, 1769, which Goodspeed estimated to differ from that of 1611 in 75,000 details, relatively unimportant details, of course, has become the standard standard form of the King James Version today, in use today. Now, to show you, this is actually not a chapter about the King James, but it's a chapter about the New King James Version. And to show you the number of changes in the New King James compared with the old King James. Thank you. That's very helpful. I'm just getting a little dry here, and we're going to wind up pretty shortly. How many differences are there between the old King James of 1769 day and the new King James, which was produced in 1975? And here's the pages. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. And you could say half of page 13. 13 pages of differences. And he gives the classification. They give the classification of all the different types of changes. Punctuation, vocalization, translation of old into the new. And to show you just a tiny little snippet of King James English. How many of these words do you know? Just to drive the point home even more clearly, what is the meaning of chambering? It gives all these biblical references. Champagne, not a drink. Charger, not a horse. churl, sealed, circumspect, clouted upon their feet, cockatrice, collops, confection, not a sweet, coats, covert, hoised, wimples, stomacher, wat, whist, whiz, want, suretyship, sackbut, the skull, scrabbled, roller, muffler, froward, brigadine, amorisi, blains. Have you got blains today? Cockatrice? Oh, no. Crookback. Crookbacked. Descry. Fanners. Fellows. Glibby. So I guess I would know about 10% of those words. You might do a little better. You might do a little worse. But as I read this book, what was the motive for making a new English translation of the Bible? And you might say, well, the scholars got together and decided all these old manuscripts. That was not the major motivation. It was a minor motivation, yes. The major motivation, as I read these stories of these translators, take Phillips, for example. He was teaching a class of young people in London, England. This is England, where they're reading the English Bible. And these young people couldn't understand it. And so that was the motivation why Phillips started to do his little translation. And actually, I like the Phillips translation. It's beautiful English. Now, it is a paraphrase, so it's a free translation. The question is just how accurate does the free translation reflect? And so you have the difference between literal and dynamic translation. And I'll give you an illustration from personal life. We had a church official come down to Nicaragua, and he was preaching to the local people there. And he said, that's as dangerous as skating on thin ice. Now, these people had never seen a frozen river, and they had never seen ice skates. And so, as he's preaching in English, the translator is translating, and he said, that's as dangerous as swimming in a river full of crocodiles. And that's what's called a dynamic translation. So, you see, you have a dynamic translation, you have a literal translation, and this Bible from 1901 didn't get very far because it was so literal. And the same is true of the 1881 English Revised Bible. And so they did not have good sales. And this committee of 30 Americans worked with 56 of the British, but they were under strict orders. They had to submit their translation to the British translation. And they couldn't produced their own for 14 years. That's why this was produced in 1901 instead of 1880. And so, poor old Westcott and Hart have been beaten up a little bit in current times. And as a matter of fact, the one Bible that you would think they would have influenced would have been the English Revised of 1881. They didn't, because their translation of the Greek, or their collation of the Greek New Testament, was just published in 1881. So here you have these two versions published side by side. Now, some of their work had been produced before that, and two other manuscript transmissions, families of texts, were incorporated into the one Bible. It was not just Westcott and Hort. And that's the only Bible that Westcott and Hort was the basis of, or part of the basis of. And so what happens? Well, the Americans go another way. And then in 1894, a man named Eberhard Nestle produced the Greek New Testament. And his work was continued by his son. And that was continued by a German fellow named Kurt Alland. Now, I studied Greek in 1950 and 50, and we used the Nestle New Testament. And maybe we heard the word Westcott and Hort twice. I don't even know if the La Sierra Library had a copy of their work. I have no idea. But we studied the Nestle New Testament, which started in 1894 and continued on. And Kurt Alland has continued that work so that we now have the 27th edition. This is Kurt Alland's work, committee. Well, Kurt Alland of Münster, Germany, Matthew Black of St. Andrews in Scotland, Bruce Metzger, Princeton, Alan Wickren of Chicago. I'll tell you a quick story. We're getting ready to wind up, but we do have a few more questions. A quick story about Bruce Metzger. we had a Seventh-day Adventist pastor named Naz Mizer. And Naz Mizer was a friend of Bruce Metzger. He pastored in New Jersey, and Princeton is in New Jersey. So he was visiting with Bruce Metzger, and he was asking him about Daniel 9:24. The RSV, of which Bruce Metzger was the chairman, says 70 weeks of years. Now, that word of years is an explanation, but it is in no Hebrew texts. And so he asked, Naz Mizer asked Bruce Metzger, are you going to keep that word years in there or take it out with the next edition? And he said, half of the committee thinks we should leave it in, and half of them think we should take it out. So that's the way translation committees work. You've heard the old story about a camel is a horse designed by a committee. And so sometimes you get that kind of effect. And committees decide which way to go. So this is the United Bible Society 3rd edition. A 4th edition has been printed. I don't have the 4th edition. Kurt Allend 27th edition is out, and parallel to the 4th edition of the UBS Bible. You know, the American Bible Society in New York, the General Conference sends a representative up to see them each year because we contribute to their production of Bibles and distribution of Bibles. And so I went one year and met some of their people, and each year it rotates as to who goes up there and so forth. But they are responsible for... The only difference between Kurt Allen's 27th edition and the United Bible Society 4th edition is the apparatus. Not the text. The text is the same. The apparatus and the listing of the different manuscripts, which are abundant. So they have all of these. All of these are listed. And so if you want to do textual criticism about the New Testament, that is the place that you have all the current the available information on all four of these. And these too, for that matter. They're in there. Now I'll tell you about text critics. Text critics are a particular type of psychology. They like details. And so they spend their life working with details. And we had a text critic, a very good one, at Andrews University. His name was Hans Erbes. He was in my department. He was a good friend of mine. And I used to visit him many times in his home, and we would have lengthy discussions about what's the most important part of Old Testament studies. And he would always say, text criticism, text criticism, text criticism, text criticism. And I'd say, well, what about theology, or what about archaeology, or what about exegesis? No, no, text criticism, text criticism. Now, this man is so single-minded that he has produced a chapter on the book of Joshua in the Peshitta. The Peshitta is the Bible in Syriac. And he even produced his own photographic techniques of how to photograph manuscripts. And those photographic techniques that he developed are better than professional photographers in biblical laboratories can do. And so when he finally produced his chapter of the book of Joshua for the Peshitta, the International Syriac Bible, he was praised to the skies by his colleagues in that Peshitta project. They said, we have never had a book of the Bible produced in such a remarkable manner. Well, that's okay if you want to spend your life dealing with details. But if you use your life dealing with details, you're going to never see the forest, and you're only going to see the trees. And so we have all of this compilation. And so my word to you is, whatever Bible you like, fine. You like the King James? A third of the United States Bible reading population still prefers the King James. Fine. But tomorrow morning, our Sabbath school lesson about Paul and Galatians is freedom in Christ. If I like the RSV, the old RSV, and you like the new RSV, don't tell me I can't read the old RSV. So my encouragement is, please, read the Bible more. Read any Bible. And get a copy. If you want to know the details about them, you can get this book for one penny. One penny plus postage. And you can find every translation in here but two. And so I was going to tell you about the new NIV. I suppose they'll have to call it the NNIV or the RNIV. Maybe it's the Ninny version. They have followed the new RSV in de-genderizing the text of the Bible. And so I would take the old NIV over the new NIV. I would take the old RSV over the new. But you might like them better. Fine. Read what you like. Read a Bible. Read any Bible. Read the Bible more. Read the Bible of your choice. If you are only reading for devotional purposes, read any Bible under the sun. If you are reading for text critical studies or doctrinal biblical studies, then I would recommend a literal version. As bad as the old 1901 version may be, it's pretty boring, it's pretty wooden in its translation, it's still a literal version. And we have basically about four literal versions. The old NIV, the old RSV, the New King James. I can read the defects of the New King James here. I've left out one. Yes, NASB, which I always preach from here. Not because I prefer it over anything, just somebody gave it to me, so I use it. So, that's my encouragement. Pick the Bible of your choice. As they used to say about elections, vote, but vote for the Kennedy of your choice. So, vote for the Bible. Pick your Bible. If you want to be an educated reader, read Kubo and Spect. If you want to just read the Bible, which you have now, fine. The more you read it, the better person you'll be. And that's my counsel to you. It opens the vista of the horizons of how God has led in His up to the present. Now, there's one Adventist version, which I'm not, but some in this church use it, the Living Bible, which is a paraphrase using, I prefer to have a pure text of the Bible and put project, but it's available. Yes. Yeah, Clear Word, I'm sorry, I said Living Word. There is a Living Word Bible. There's an Amplified Bible. Let me just read the list. Incidentally, he even has the Jehovah's Witness Bible in here, and the Jehovah's Witness Bible has Jehovah in the New Testament, 272 times, for which there is no basis in the Greek. But the early modern speech versions, Weymouth, Moffat, then the RSV, the Revised Standard Version, then there's the Catholic form of that, the Knox Translation, another Catholic Bible, Phillips, Modern Language Bible, New World Translation, and he goes through all the biased translations, to be fair. The New Jewish Version, it has three Catholic Bibles and one Jewish Bible. The Amplified Bible, the Jerusalem Bible, another Catholic Bible. Barclay's New Testament, Good News Bible, New English Bible, New American Bible, New American Standard, the Living Bible, New International Version, New King James, Reader's Digest Bible. And then they even got to the what they call some colorful versions. Try these on. The Cotton Patch Version. God is for Real Man. The Word Made Flesh, the Gospel in Schools, I guess that's British. And so they give you some guidelines for choosing a version. So God bless you in your reading of His Word. May it become richer and richer and richer to you as more and more developments on the horizon. And who knows where the next manuscript discovery will come from. The Gospel of John, back to 125 A.D., could we get the book of Revelation back to 100 A.D. or the Gospel of Peter, the first and second Peter back to 80 A.D. or whatever? You know, there may well be more to come. That's why the early Bibles, you know, Old Testament scholars fight over what's the earliest Hebrew inscription. That's why these appeal to me the most as the standard for our translations. There is 5 minutes for questions. We have a mic. You may be tired. It's 5 minutes of nine, according to the clock in the back. I assume you probably are. Well, there's a lot. Yes.
I was told that the Clear Word wasn't really a Bible.
Yeah, that's true. He will acknowledge that if you will pin him down. Jack Blanco from Southern College. I listened to him give some of it at camp meetings as devotionals. So he says, I just got this much written, and then he'd read. DeAndre's Bible is a study Bible. The text is the text of the NIV, I believe, but the main thing is the footnotes and the discussions of all kinds of matters relating to the Scriptures. So the text has not been changed, but the footnotes and the commentary is about what archaeology tells us, what manuscripts tell us, what exegesis tells us, what theology tells us. So it's a very large compilation. Andrew's study Bible. That's why they call it a study Bible. All right? Yes?
Do you are you with J.P. Green and his translations? Or
I have read of him. Okay. I have not seen his translation. He is an ardent King James advocate, which is fine. He may overstate the case a little bit. And as I say, you have to take into account that the King James Bible was an ongoing. It was not a dead letter when it arrived. It was a living letter. So we don't read 1769 English. And so, you have to decide which version of King James you're defending. And he has to decide that too. And you can see between the 1769 version and the 1975 version, the New King James, which incidentally tried to stay by the manuscripts that the old King James used, the so-called Textus Receptus. It was Erasmus, basic underlining. So they have tried to stay with that text tradition, even though they acknowledge that there are more recent discoveries of older manuscripts.
Actually, I guess I do have one question, and that is, sort of deals with, have you read Peterson's translation, The Message?
Who's?
Eugene Peterson, The Message.
I know of him. I think he worked with Eugene Nida.
Well, supposedly
who was one who was giving them information on translation techniques.
Right, and he had studied the Bible in, like you may read, in he had studied in the original languages and then was impressed. But I guess the reason I ask, you talk about literal translation versus dynamic translation, and he refers to it as thought translation. Is, I guess, the equivalent of dynamic translation.
Yeah.
Trying to take the meaning of what was written and put it in, think of it today, rather than what the actual words used were.
Yeah. There are, it's not black and white. There's a shade, a spectrum. You know, here's literal over here. In fact, they have these book examples where the English word order tries to follow the Greek word order. And it ends up as a mishmash. You can't make sense of it. And some of those literal versions do that. And then there's the dynamic translation at the far extreme, which is a paraphrase. But in between, there are those who have tried to make English language more modern so that we may understand it, but not take it totally away from the original text. And so there's gradations. There's not just one here and one there. It's a spectrum. And that's why, when you get a new Bible, read the introduction, because in the introduction, the translator will tell you the techniques of translation. Just to give one simple illustration, which I think is rather glaring, the King James Bible does not print poetry in poetry. It prints it in prose. And one-third of the Hebrew Old Testament is poetry. And so, to my understanding, the Hebrew Bible prints poetry in poetry, and therefore it seems like the sensible thing is most modern English versions translate poetry as poetry. And so that gives you the lines, which make poetry so much easier to understand and so much easier to read. But some versions have reverted back to not translating it. For instance, I'll take a simple illustration. Sermon on the Mount, prose, Lord's Prayer in poetry, prose. Why can we put the Lord's Prayer to music so easily? Because it's poetry. Poetry has meter, the length of line. And so when you have meter and the length of line, then you can set that to music. Prose just is run-on. You can't set that to music without rephrasing it, you see. So that's just one simple illustration of translational techniques. Since I've written a few articles on Hebrew poetry, it obviously makes good. Incidentally, for those of you who think I'm advocating the Sinaiticus, I have written an article against the Sinaiticus, believe it or not, because the Sinaiticus put in two books in the Apocrypha. One is the Epistle of Barnabas, and one is the Shepherd of Hermas. And if you believe the Epistle of Barnabas, you'll give up Sabbath keeping and you'll keep Sunday. And so my article was the Epistle of Barnabas, which is in the... And it's a harshly anti-Semitic letter. Everything is wrong with Judaism. That's the Epistle of Barnabas. The covenant is wrong. The sacrifices are wrong. The priests are wrong. Everything's wrong. Abraham's wrong. Abraham's covenant's wrong. Everything's wrong. The Sabbath is wrong. So, you know, here's an Egyptian writing about 140 A.D. that totally dismisses everything Jewish, including the Sabbath. And that's really kind of what happened to the Sabbath. So that was the first article I ever published, 1960. It's still gathering dust, and nobody's read it since. Well, I think that's enough. Shall we stand for prayer? Oh, yes. Wait, one more question.
Lastly, but not least, can we all consider that writing?
When were they writing? Yes, of course. Any version, and I think you've made the same point, any version of the Bible, even the cotton patch version, you can learn the plan of salvation from it. Okay, let's stand. Loving Father, again, we thank you for your word, and we know it leads us onward to your kingdom. And we thank you for the way in which it has been preserved. We thank you for the many copies of it. We thank you that people are so interested in it that they still work on it and study it and translate it. And Lord, we ask you to give us wisdom to rightly divide your word of truth. And we ask you to lead us onto your kingdom by means of this word, and give us the plan of salvation from it. For we ask it in Jesus' name. Amen.
You have been listening to another special American Christian Ministries presentation. This is a digital recording for optimum sound quality. International copyright, all rights reserved. To order a copy of this or other presentations, or for a free catalog, please call toll-free 800-233-4450. International calls dial 717-652-7000. You may also order from our secure website at www.AmericanChristianMinistry.org. There you will discover the largest selection of authentic Adventist preaching available. You can trust ACM. There's no compromise here. If American Christian Ministries has been a blessing to you, why not take a moment just now and send us a note or an email with your testimony? We'll share it with the speakers and volunteer workers to encourage them. Your prayers and continued financial support are very important to ensure the continuation of this ministry, as we help prepare America and the world to meet Jesus Christ. He is coming soon.